This is Monocle on Design, a show where we unpack everything from architecture and craft to furniture and fashion. I'm Nick Benice. On today's program, it's a Christmas special. We head to Naples and to the Nordics for some seasonal fun, and we soak up some festive cheer here in London. All that and more coming up on Monocle on Design. Welcome to today's show, coming to you directly from Monocle Radio's pop-up studio at Monocle's Christmas Market in London. You can hear, a scene setter in the background. We've got a choir going. I've got Carlotta Ribello from Monocle's The Urbanist sitting opposite me. Welcome, Carlotta.
Hi, Nick.
Now, look, we're recording this on a brisk Saturday morning, and by the time it airs, we'll be packed up here in Marylebone. But across December, the Monocle team is out in festive force across Europe. We've got a pop-up shop at Hotel Stefani in St. Moritz. That's now open and serving up coffee and Alpine essentials until the 31st of March. We've also got a shop in-shop in Paris in the Tiptoe flagship. That runs until the 22nd of January. And if you stop in there, you'll be able to see Tiptoe's Lou stool in an exclusive Monocle colorway. That's a collaboration we've worked on. Now, both are installations that are livening up the neighbourhoods they're in. And it's why, again, as I mentioned, Carlotta from The Urbanist is here to talk about, I want to talk about urban design and urban interventions in a seasonal context, much like these shop in shops, much like these markets. I mean, Carlotta, how does urban design, or these temporary urban designs that are linked to Christmas, change our cities?
I mean, the most famous contemporary design and the seasonal design that happens every season across cities across around the world is, of course, the Christmas lights. You know, it might seem like a small little detail, but you'll find it very difficult to find one city in the world that doesn't put up a light installation related to this season. And, you know, in London, it's been going on since the 1940s. And it really is not just about, you know, beautiful displays, but it really has the power of transforming a neighborhood and connecting perhaps areas that in the usual round the year, apart from Christmas, you might not join them up. But then through lighting design, you can kind of create a circuit as well. Let's take the example of London. You have, of course, the famous Regent Street and Oxford Street, high shopping destinations, but a lot of the side streets around there kind of get missed throughout the year. But this is the one season where it's all joined up because the lights kind of guide you through it. Now, much like a pop-up market like ours here outside Midori House, pop-up markets around the world transform public spaces. These reclaim areas of the city that sometimes are not accessible to people. Often they might be behind closed doors or behind tickets. By installing, ice rinks or Christmas markets, you get to experience something new. If it's in a place, let's say in London, Somerset House has a very famous ice rink every year. A lot of people that do go and use it might not be people who traditionally would go to Somerset House to visit some of the exhibitions, and they make it this their annual excursion. So there's this power as well of rediscovering the places you call home through these temporary installations.
What I want to talk to you about, you mentioned London. We talk about since the 1940s, we've had Christmas lights here. You live in different parts of the city to where you work and to where you socialise. We're both in the east. We work in the west. We're at the market here in the west. Where are the nicest or the best designs of lights that you've seen this year?
So if you want to go traditional, of course it has to be...
I like this. You were ready to go
for
this.
I'm Mrs. Claus over here. So if you want to go traditional, of course you have to visit what we mentioned, Oxford Street, Regent Street, all the way down to the West End is beautiful, particularly when you get as well the lights from the theatres. And it's a fantastic, iconic London tradition, and you get to see the outside of the shops as well. Another one is, of course, the window displays at Harrods. You cannot miss that. Design and window dressing really plays an important role in storytelling, and it has become a tradition. You go there, you look at the windows, and you see the beautiful installation. Selfridges does it as well, but Harrods, it's an icon. But if you veer towards east, where we both live, as you might have noticed, the Christmas decorations are not as out there, because it pays homage to the mix of cultures that you have in London. So traditionally in East London, you have a lot of people of Muslim faith and also of Hindu faith. So Christmas is not something that is celebrated, and therefore you'll have some Christmas displays, Christmas lights, but not as out there. And I think that's just a nod to recognizing the diversity in your city, to paying homage to them, and to be able to, combine all these elements. It is the season. it is happy holidays, and everyone should feel included regardless of where they live.
You talk about cultures and the influence that I guess culture can have on and the design of these temporary streetscapes.
Mm.
You're from Portugal. Tell us a little bit about what one might expect to see across the Lusophone world.
Almost every single city will have a giant Christmas tree. This is like a fake Christmas tree, like made out of lights, not a plastic one. Like,
is it tacky though? Can I ask?
Well, when I lived there, I would say yes. But now, because I live abroad, I find it endearing because I know immediately I'm home. I struggle to think of a city that does not have a sort of ginormous light Christmas tree that you can walk inside and kind of like look up. Kids love it. There's lights everywhere. But it seems to be a kind of Portuguese thing. Like, we don't see that in London. You might have one or two, but not like in every single place. And when I travel around the world, it's not a thing that I see everywhere. So I don't know where our fascination with it comes from. Sadly, it was last week only that Lisbon lit up its Christmas decorations. And unfortunately, it coincided with this huge rainstorm. So the mayor had to postpone it by a day because otherwise there would be no one to watch the lights being turned on because of the floods. But they have been on now, from what I gather, quite successful, and they're very beautiful.
Absolute treat. My last question, I mean, I know that the urbanists will do a few festive things. Let's do a little bit of cross promo here. What can we expect on your festive Christmas shows?
Well, Nick, if you are surprised at my deep knowledge of Christmas lights, it's because we have, of course, a special coming on the Urbanist about Christmas lights in London and its history. So from the beginning of the lights, which were during the war, and it was used as a way of brightening up London and to give a bit of seasonal joy in the city that was, you know, facing hardship, and a tradition that has really stuck. So we have an episode dedicated to that, and we will also be showcasing a few Christmas markets around the world. So a lot of festive treats, and exactly about, you know, just how this is a season too that transforms our cities and allows you to imagine public space in a different way.
That sounds amazing. That was Monocle Radio's Carlotta Rabello, producer of The Urbanist. We'll be right back after this. In cities worldwide, Christmas crafts are closely linked with their regions and people. Works might span from bespoke festive decorations to custom nativity sets by traditional craftspeople. It's something that Monocle's Bella Jewell investigated in this special report from southern Italy.
On an evening walk along one of Naples' busiest streets, I discovered a small hole in the wall under some scaffolding. Blasting Christmas music into Via dei Tribunali, a hand-painted sign reads Museo Permanente del Presepe, the permanent museum of the Neapolitan Nativity set. Inside, I met Francesco Viscione, a small man with bushy eyebrows. He's smoking a cigarette and drinking an espresso. Around him are work tools, boxes of cork and pallets of paint. And in the centre of his studio, a grand five-storey nativity set. In Naples, it's called a presepe.
Ci sono tutti I personaggi del presepe. E questo è il grottino degli asini, tutti I nomi di fantasia.
Francesco talks me through his presepe. That droning noise in the background, well, it's the entire five-foot structure rotating. You see, in Naples, the nativity set isn't a simple affair.
Il presepe rappresenta noi, l'umanità in cammino.
Francesco tells me that the point of the Neapolitan presepe is that it represents us, humankind, as we move forward. On his mega structure, he has tens of little figurines.
Troviamo la bella donna come te. Troviamo la vecchia, la brutta. Troviamo.
Characters include the beautiful woman, the ugly, the old, the young, the rich, and the poor. You may also recognize some other classic nativity characters like Mary, Joseph, and the baby Jesus, and the three wise men. In the Neapolitan presepe, they kneel in front of a cave instead of a stable. Francesco's presepe is lit from within with LED lights, and on the second floor is a fully functioning miniature waterfall. But for this retired musicologist, presepe making is just a hobby.
Per me, personalmente, che sono un amatore, il presepe mi viene in automatico.
The self-professed amateur comes to his workshop at the end of a day to unwind. He tells me that presepe making is a skill that comes to him automatically, like muscle memory. Just down the street, though, on a straight road called Via San Gregorio Armeno, the art of presepe making is far from a hobby. It's a trade which goes back centuries.
We should really start from the very beginning, telling a little bit of the story of the presepe in Naples that becomes very famous because during the 18th century, they started creating nativity scenes that were absolutely magnificent.
I met Carmine Romano a few hundred metres away from Francesco's workshop. He's an art historian and curator and has written several books about the Neapolitan presepe.
We are going up, we are passing through San Gregorio Armeno, which is, in the last 60, 80 years, is really considered as the most important streets for Christmas decorations and, of course, for the crèche, the presepio. We are entering in an important building from the 12th century with a nice courtyard. And, of course, it's a pastiche of other architecture with the Aragonese period and Spanish period. And there are some what we call scoglio, which is the scenography for the presepe. The presepe is usually the ensemble of a scenography and, of course, the figures themselves.
In front of us in this courtyard are an array of beautiful presepi, multi-story miniature buildings with caves, open rooms, and often the ruins of a classical temple. Inside are a multitude of little figurines.
The scenography is made by cork and is painted cork. Of course, we have also, as you can see here, we have some papier-mâché, we have some glued paper and wood, real branches of trees with leaves, still dry leaves, to keep it everything more natural.
These presepi have a really organic feel. They're covered in moss and decorated with twigs. Everything is painted in warm tones, yellows, browns and greens. It feels like we've left the 21st century behind and have travelled back 300 years.
The crèche itself is really a Baroque product. So you really try to imitate the life of everything. So when you want to recreate a food, for example, they were using wax because the transparency and the texture of the wax is very close to the food. Everything must be like it would have been in the real life.
And it's not just the materials that are Baroque.
All the figures in the Neapolitan presepe of the 18th century are dressed up like contemporary style girls, women, and men, of course, and also all the objects and also everything that is on the crèche, like houses and objects of daily life, they are just reproductions of what you would have been in the 18th century. So it's also a document, an historical document of what was the life of Naples in that period. We have a body that is made by iron wire and also hemp to give the consistency of the body and also to give the possibility to move the hands and the limbs. And then you would have had a head that is in terracotta, which is the only part of the figure that is modeled by the artists, and then dress up like with clothes and real fabrics.
Alongside the elaborate cork nativity sets on Via San Gregorio Armeno are rows of shops selling individual figurines called pastori. In contrast to the historical nativity scenes, these pastori can be a little more kitsch.
Il presidente Biden, il principe William con la consorte, il sempreverde Maradona, Marilyn Monroe, Karl Lagerfeld per quanto riguarda la moda.
That's right, we've travelled from the late 17th century, early 18th century to the modern day. Gennaro Gigliano works in a traditional workshop here. He points out mini Maradonas and members of the British royal family. You may think that the artisans here are simply cashing in on tourism, producing jokey celebrity memorabilia. But just like the presepe, these figures are part and parcel of the artisan tradition of this neighbourhood.
Since the Greek and the Roman period, this street was full of shops of artisans that were creating small little figures in terracotta that were given as an ex votum to the temple. So what they do now is just what they were doing even before Christ was born. So it's even before the Christianity. It's just reusing the old figures and personages in a kind of new way.
Just now I saw a man dragging an entire presepe wrapped in bubble wrap. Yeah. Is this still something that people have in their homes in Naples around Christmas time?
Everyone that can consider himself as a Neapolitan must have a creche in the house. Of course, it's your grandpa that brings you in front of the creche for the first time and explains to you all the details and all the fruits and vegetables and the animals, the cats and the sheep. And at a certain point, there is a personage that is called Benino, and is a sleeping shepherd just right in the corner.
Benino is an essential character in the Neapolitan presepe. He's always asleep, curled up against a rock, and often surrounded by 12 sheep, representing the 12 apostles.
And at a certain point, usually the grandfather tells you, shh, be quiet, don't speak loud, because if he wakes up, the entire creche disappears, because the creche is the dream of Benino.
I presepi are a fundamental part of Neapolitan culture and history. And while other traditional crafts slowly disappear from the city's streets, like the tailors and leather shoemakers, it seems like the nativity artisans are here to stay.
We have some families that are passing their knowledge from the father to the son. We are now in front of Rigno, Capuano. That's the fourth or the fifth generations of artisans. This year, for example, the mayor is founding this new school for artisans of the presepe, trying to pass this knowledge because it's bringing money. Of course, we had the COVID period that put everyone down, but after it, it has been like an explosion.
For Monocle in Naples, I'm Isabella Jewell.
The first Sunday of Advent marks an important day on Nordic calendars. It's when households across the region put up traditional paper stars that hang in windows, brightening up homes and streets. For more on this festive tradition and the importance of good lighting, here's Monocle's Gabriele Della Santi.
It's no secret that the Scandinavians know a thing or two about well-designed interiors. I spent over 7 years living in Copenhagen, discovering the many ways in which locals manage to successfully transform an apartment into a welcoming home. And if there is one element that always stood out to me was the emphasis on good lighting. And I'm not just talking about burning a few candles here and there to achieve maximum hygge, but rather how light, often kept dim, warm and balanced, is used as a defining and crucial element in making a space. And there is no better reminder about the Danes' skillful use of light than during Christmas time. Just walk down the streets of Copenhagen as the darkness sets in just past 3 p.m. The broad and mostly curtainless windows of the city's apartment blocks reveal the inviting interiors that Copenhagen carefully curate for themselves at this time of year. And what I find interesting is how the element of light, coupled with an abundance of Christmas decorations, not only serves to brighten up homes, but the streets too. Grids of apartment windows turn into a mosaic of glowing light that contributes to the city's festive decorations. And among the most noticeable elements is the Advent Star, or Adventsstjerne in Danish. It is a popular ornament across the Nordic countries that usually appears starting from the first Sunday of Advent. These festive stars come in many different materials, shapes, sizes, and colors. Many are made of a warm white shade of paper and have a clean and minimal design, while others are in metal, ornamented with intricate cutouts and colored in different seasonal hues. Just like many Christmas decorations, these pieces originated in Germany. The first one is believed to have popped up in 1821 and was shaped as a Moravian star, which is characterized by its many spikes in all directions. As the decorations were then imported to Scandinavia in the early 1900s, the star took on a simpler form, featuring the classic five-pointed shape. Sweden played a big role in popularizing the ornament across the region. It was none other than one of the founders of fashion giant H&M who introduced a paper version of the ornaments. These proved to be more affordable for Swedes compared to the leather ones imported from Germany. So, if I had one tip on how to turn your home and street a little cozier this Christmas time, hanging an Advent star in whatever form, color, and shape you prefer might be a good place to start. For Monocle in Copenhagen, I'm Gabriele Delisanti.
Next up on today's show, we visit the 7th edition of the Gingerbread City exhibition in London. The annual sweet-smelling metropolis champions sustainable design ideas in food form. It includes edible houses, train stations, bridges, and parks. Monocle's Harrison Warlock headed to the showcase to meet Melissa Woolford, the creator of the concept, and Madeline Kessler, one of the architects behind this year's impressive installation. Let's hear from Melissa now.
The idea behind Gingerbread City is to help the public better engage with architecture. The idea is that people who otherwise might not go to an architecture exhibition have a chance to be exposed to real architectural concepts and ideas. This year's theme is around water in cities. And so we're tackling things like climate change and how cities are dealing more now with working with water as opposed to just keeping it out. And so we're addressing these issues through these four different islands that we have.
And Madeline, how do you set about master planning a Gingerbread City?
Good question. I think initially it's almost like a real master plan. We take it quite seriously and we start off by drawing out and outlining these kind of islands around these different themes, thinking about the people who might use them. You know, we have very real kind of places in them, like a school or hospital. We start off by thinking about these different themes around the wider topic this year, which was water. And then we create a different kind of sub-theme of that around these different islands. So whether that be underwater, urban floodplain, canal city, a frozen landscape. And much like a real master plan, we start thinking about the different people that might use these landscapes and places and think about real kind of places that will be required within that. So everything from a school to a hospital to housing. And then we illustrate this through an illustration accompanied by a master planning document. And that document has very real kind of constraints to it around the different plots and what they might be, alongside how high the structures might be, how big they are. And then the architects take that and they sort of come back with something really creative. And they take those kind of real-world constraints and come back with these incredible kind of structures and interpretations of what these places could be.
And so in past years, you've hosted the Gingerbread City in smaller galleries. Why now more public space?
It's really important for us to grow our audience and to talk to people who otherwise wouldn't necessarily go into one of those galleries or museum spaces. I mean, being at Westfield White City, which is the biggest mall in Europe, gives us such a great opportunity to do that. I'm so excited to be here and to talk to everyone and have them experience architecture in a really accessible way.
Do you have any tips or tricks for the audience who want to make gingerbread houses at home?
I think the thing is that you don't have to create that traditional gingerbread structure that you kind of see, that traditional house with the slope roof. I think, you know, be imaginative, be creative, think about different spaces that you might like to live or play, or design something that's not a house and design something that's maybe a school or a playground. And you can use gingerbread and sweets in so many different ways. And here you can see great examples of how people have used polos for wheels and all different kinds of things. So go out there, try to do something creative that's not a traditional house.
Have fun with it. And also it's such a good opportunity to sort of bring different people together. And I think that's something that's so successful about the Gingerbread City, actually, is much like a real city, the success of it is all these different ideas coming together, all these different people coming together. And that it's really sort of, it's not architecture for architects, you know, it's about sort of engaging that wider public, these real world problems, sort of thinking about them, but in a really creative and fun way. And I'd say if you're making something out of gingerbread, you know, just go wild. And you never know where that's going to take you and what might happen with your structure. But I guarantee it will sort of take you out of your constraints to just really free you up your thinking.
My thanks to Harrison Warlock for that report. The Gingerbread City is on at Westfield White City in London until the 7th of January 2024. And listeners in New York can also visit their own iteration of the Gingerbread City running until the 16th of January. Next on today's show, we head to a new alpine chalet built to host ski camps for kids. Here, the architecture shuns traditional Swiss forms in favour of its young guests' needs. For more, it's over to Monocle's Grace Charlton.
It's hard to imagine a more Swiss school holiday scene than the goings-on at Les Cabris Chalet. Children run around with sunburnt outlines of ski goggles contouring their faces, shouting to each other in German, English and French about misplaced socks, beanies and skiing thermals. It's Friday, the last day of ski camp, and a cohort of ninth graders from Geneva-headquartered École Mosère greet me. From the outside, the chalet is an imposing three-story structure that zigzags along a ridge at the edge of a pinewood forest overlooking the alpine village of Lézan. With its black wood panelled exterior and floor-to-ceiling windows, it appears far too polished to be mostly frequented by school children, but it was commissioned by Alain Mosère, the director of École Mosère, whose original building, located on the same site, was falling into disrepair. Here, he saw an opportunity to reimagine the traditional ski chalet from which many schools in Switzerland run winter sports programs, breaking from the dark and boxy forms often associated with such buildings. As a result, Geneva-based architecture studio Meyer et Associés were tasked with creating a building which is now entering its third full ski season that would invite light and levity to the site and serve as a benchmark for similar chalets. The architect behind the ski school, Anna Ines Peppermans, wanted to angle the building towards the Dent du Midi mountain range. From there, the layout for the bedrooms, the large-scale kitchen, dining area, and communal spaces was decided. The emphasis was put on communal areas so that the children feel encouraged to socialize and are able to use the space for different activities, be it ping-pong, yoga classes, playing chess or cards, or watching movies. Moser also asked to include a large climbing wall at the center of the building for days on which the weather does not allow for skiing or hiking. Calming spaces were also accounted for in the building's programming, with forest-facing rooms used for sleeping and downtime. The bedrooms cater to what children want. Instead of wardrobes, tables were installed for suitcases to be left on and stay open for the duration of the stay, without any organizing or putting away of items. Designing with these youthful end users in mind also resulted in bathrooms with durable tiling, plenty of sinks for toothbrushing, and enough showers for all. Meyer et Associés were also concerned with grounding the building in the Swiss landscape and ensuring it could survive the alpine elements. Avalanches and landslides are a reality that architects building in the mountains need to reckon with. As such, stones from the nearby Rhône River were used in the concrete mix for structural components, due to the material strength and resistance to the natural elements. Inside, blonde wood finishes bring a lighter touch to the space and hark back to the more traditional ski cabin architectural vernacular found across Switzerland. As I depart, the school children are stowing their suitcases next to the building's wood-panelled ski room. And while Les Cabris belongs to École Mosère and its primary purpose is to serve as a base for its ski camps, the building is available year-round for renting by other schools or groups of adults looking for an alpine escape or company retreat. It means those looking to experience the architect's work firsthand can simply book themselves a bed.
My thanks there to Grace Charlton. For more on winter architecture and design, pick up a copy of Monocle's seasonal newspaper, The Alpino, at monocle.com/shop. And that's all for today's show. For more Monocle Christmas festivities, check out our winter outposts in St. Moritz and Paris. And for more design stories, listen to our 5-minute midweek bonus show, Monocle on Design Extra, which airs on Thursdays. Today's episode was produced and edited by Maylee Evans. I'm Nick Manise, and you can reach me on nm@monocle.com. Thanks for listening, and Merry Christmas.